Any preliminaries from the authorities? Are there any authorities? Okay. Let's go. I said, Riju Mati asked if he could ask a question last night, and I forbade it, saying that I would start with questions today. But let's put it this way. I think I'd rather just carry on and get a little bit of momentum up, and the same issues will arise. So if there are burning questions and you can hold them, my request is that you do. If you can't, then burst now and I will deal with it. Anything that anybody has to have dealt with, sorry, being flippant, but anything that anybody find it difficult to go on without dealing with first. Yes, you. Oh my goodness. Okay. I usually don't have that problem. So if you find you're not hearing me, wave. Okay. I've usually got a stentorian voice which can be heard everywhere. Yes, G.
I don't want to prejudge what you're going to say, but I think from last night I was a little unclear on how you're going to play it, because it seemed a little strange that that to me we either have to have a kind of imaginative engagement, which is very practical, and sort of get the paints out and start having a real hands-on type thing, or else we have a much more kind of philosophical approach. And if we do that, then there's a whole mass of stuff that I've got, because I think it's philosophically problematic. I'm quite happy to have a kind of imaginative engagement, but I mean, whereas the way you presented it yesterday seems to be trying to ride both horses.
I shall continue to try to ride both horses, I'm afraid, in a very unsatisfactory sort of way, because essentially the horses are not so easily separable,
okay,
if you see what I mean. But yes, my intention is to speak, if you like. I don't know whether you could say it's theoretically, but conceptually, about the role of imagination in spiritual life. And of course, if that raises issues, I'm very happy to discuss them when the time comes. I'm not really the man for the paints and so forth. I'm sure it would be a very good thing to do, but it's not my sort of gift. But I would like to do some exploration, partly as more of a sort of examination or even survey. I started this morning, many of you were there present for it, with an attempt to phrase a, if you like, sadhana practice with much less specific detail. I don't know whether I'm successful, but I'm trying to follow the broad form of a sadhana practice without specific detail, because I think that we've got to try to rediscover what it means. So I can explore in that way, but I'm not really the man for the paints and so forth stuff. Not at the moment, anyway.
Yeah, that was a slight euphemism.
I'm sorry?
That was being slightly euphemistic there.
Yeah. No, I'm taking the meaning of your euphemism. Yeah. So I hope this is not too unsatisfactory for you, but I will try to. I think my contribution can be to try to clarify issues, and especially to try to draw out of what Bhante has to say what I think needs to be explored more deeply and fully, no doubt by others who are more capable in a more practical and active sense. So. Yes, I cover again some of the ground that I talked of last night, especially about why this particular issue has been pressing itself upon me, the issue of imagination, without at the moment defining that at all precisely. First of all, there's my own complicated experience of trying to engage with the imagery of traditional Buddhism, and especially of Tibetan Buddhism, which being a faithful fellow. I've done my best to take on. I've not had any sort of, instinctive resistance to it. And I did get a lot from doing, first of all, the Vajrasattva practice and the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana. But I always noticed there was some sort of longing in me, very inchoate. I couldn't put into words some sense that something in me was not engaging. And I always assumed it was simply enlightenment, as it were. I wasn't sufficiently awakened. But I've thought more recently, over the last 10 or 15 years, when I've been trying to meditate in a more intuitive way, trying to allow something's unfolded in my own meditation, which I've dared to follow. And that following that through has sort of disconnected me more and more from the traditional forms of practice that I inherited from Bhante, via Bhante from the Tibetan tradition. I know some people don't have that difficulty, so I'm not trying to make any overall judgments. And if people do connect with that, I'm very pleased indeed. And I think that anybody who's even connecting as much as I did will get a lot from it. It's not something to not do simply on doctrinaire grounds. But yes, it sort of puzzled me from a personal point of view that in some way my own mind has not engaged deeply enough with the forms and the structures that have been given to me. And Bhante himself began to unravel it further for me by kind of questioning the approach. I think it was in 1994 that he first started raising questions about it. But he was very reluctant to go further at that time. But it did have quite a big effect on me and altered the whole way in which I practiced. And I do think that probably more of us need to have more confidence in our own minds, if you see what I mean, that unfolding spiritual experience is going to happen under the law of karma, under the law of dharma. If you are practicing the dharma, something will begin to unfold. Of course it will. If it didn't, then why are we bothering? I began to trust more and more in something unfolding within me and to reflect more and more upon what it meant to be a Westerner engaging in the Dhamma, or as a Westerner engaging in the Dhamma. So that line of thinking was going on. And parallel with that, I've been investigating especially the history of Christianity in the West. I was brought up as Church of England Christian. Yes, Catholic, the Holy Catholic Church, not the Roman Catholic Church. And many features of it I loved and love today. The architecture and the music and the Book of Common Prayer, which we don't use anymore, etc. The authorized version, beautiful, beautiful language, the most beautiful language in English apart from Shakespeare. So I've been quite interested in my own sort of religio-psychic history as an English Buddhist who came from a Christian background. And I found some very, very interesting patterns emerge when one looks at the history of Christianity in England especially. It's different in different countries. I'll talk more about that, but at the same time that's been paralleled by the sense I talked of last night of an imaginative crisis for Indian Buddhists who are all of them coming from a Hindu background, even if they're second or third generation from that background, but some will be first generation from that background. Their own parents will still be Hindus. Where they've for psychological and social necessity had to cut themselves off from an imaginative background of astonishing richness and life. Hinduism is very, very much alive. People feel and see the presence of the gods, especially the more local gods, today. They're always appearing to people. People are having visions. People feel their presence very, very strongly. So our Indian Buddhist friends have had to cut themselves off from that in order to become Buddhist. And what's alarmed me about that is that, yes, very often it leaves them with a sort of poor imitation of Western rationalism, because they haven't got the same, historical, cultural relationship to that process. I sort of worry about what that's going to do. What I'm most concerned about is that because imaginative life is life, it's where life is, they will find themselves back in Hinduism with all that that means. I think that's likely to happen to many Buddhists in India. And it's already happening. We know that. We've seen many of our of the people we're associated with, the gods are coming back. Because they need that psychic life, that imaginative life. So that the same problem arises in India as happens for us in the West. In the West, I think it's even more complex. Bhante says in St. Jerome Revisited that we live amidst broken images. And one of the most alarming features of modern culture is the extent to which images have been debased, distorted, and perverted. There are many exceptions to all these sort of grand generalizations, of course, but as a whole, images are used for trivial purposes, for purposes of advertising, for purposes of entertainment, and the most powerful images are often viewed as under the heading of psychopathology, appearing in mental illness. There are counter movements to that, very definitely, and you do see images used very well, particularly in cinema. I think there's more imaginative life in cinema than perhaps anywhere else in modern culture. But by and large, we live amidst broken images. You go into a supermarket or a shopping centre, and I don't know what your experience is, but my immediate psychic aesthetic experience is of airlessness, of claustrophobia, of imaginative starvation, imaginative cramping. It's a ghastly environment. And you'll see a Buddha image, for instance, but it's a commercial object. And so on. You see profound images used, perverted for commercial or entertainment or mere decoration. So we live in a culture where the whole imaginative realm is by and large, in the popular culture, debased, devalued, distorted. There's a long history to this. Europe was like India is today until the early period after Christianity, after Christ. It was a pagan world. The pagan gods and goddesses and godlings all lived for people and into historical times. At a popular level, they lived really until the last century. In rural areas, perhaps in parts of Europe, they live very much still. Amongst my gypsy friends, they're very, very much alive. But for most educated, civilized, in the sense of living in cities, people, that world has just gone. Because, first of all, when Christianity fought for power, imaginative power, it suppressed the whole pagan pantheon. It fought a definite, clear battle with it. Only in a few places principally in Ireland, was more of a compromise made with that pagan past. In Britain, we know that it was very definitely suppressed, co-opted, and relegated to the devil. And the devil is almost certainly imagined on the basis of pre-existing nature spirits. So the first thing that happened was that, that there was a colonization of the imagination, of Europe, by a Christianity which abrogated to itself all magical authority. All thaumaturgic power was in the hands of the church. It accepted and recognized magic, but believed that any magic that was not under the control of the church was in the power of the devil. So the mystery of transubstantiation is a magical event. It's an imaginative magical event. The bread and wine change into the blood and body of Christ. That's what they say. So the church took into its own control the power of imagination. With the rise of Protestantism, that process went far further, and with extreme Protestant churches, of course, Cambridge was a hotbed of Calvinism. It was the principal centre for Calvinism in Britain. The destruction of images took on a really extreme form, particularly under Edward VI. The glass was smashed from the windows. The saints were destroyed. All imagery was chased out of the churches. One of the fascinating things about Shakespeare's life is that his father was I can't remember the name for it now, but the mayor of Stratford-on-Avon when the images were whitewashed in the Stratford churches. So we have the account books where he signed off for a painter to come and whitewash out the doom over the chancel, the pictures of all the saints around the walls in the Guild Chapel and in the Trinity Church where Shakespeare is buried, just peeping through the whitewash now. One of the things that's said about Shakespeare is that he was the first generation which had known, just distantly known, this rich, rich imaginative Catholic world, seen it disappear. And his vivid imagery is, as it were, a transposition of that richness and colour into literature, into words. But looking back at our own imaginations, we first of all got this cutting off of the whole pagan animist world, the restriction of magic to the church, and then a desiccation of the imagery, its banishment from the church by the Protestant Reformation. Of course, in Britain, there was a sort of movement back, and the Church of England became rather more full of imagery and life than that the Calvinists would have liked than, for instance, you get in Holland. But nonetheless, it was a severely restricted imaginative world. That itself naturally led to the rise of scientism. Once you remove the imaginative realm, you overstress the importance, the significance of the material world, the factual world, as it were. So you get an enthronement of the material universe, and a banishment of imagination to mere entertainment, or yes, to some extent, to art. So the extreme of it is Gradgrind in Hard Times. You know, facts, facts, facts would not allow any carpet to be on the floor that had a representation of flowers. Dickens is satirising an extreme of rationalism and of commercial narrowing of consciousness. So we've got this sort of archaeology of the suppression and banishment of imagination as a supreme power in life to the early people of this nation. The world was just peopled with imaginative beings. Gods, goddesses, spirits were everywhere. Every tree had some life to it. And it's still the case for probably the great majority of humanity today in India. It's very clear most people are all the time conscious of an animated world. But for us, that has been gradually eroded in a particularly complex history. It's not the only aspect of European history, of course, of English history. There was a parallel tradition or parallel traditions that survived as well, often in very strange symbiosis with Protestantism and so forth. You first of all got the classical traditions of Greece and Rome. And many educated people would have strong feelings for the Greek and Roman deities, who would be sort of living presences for them, even though they could quite faithfully go to church and declare that they were an abomination and so forth. You get a very interesting dialogue in educated life between these two strands in Western imagination, to put it that way, Western culture. Of course, you also got the Hermetic tradition, the whole alchemical and magical tradition. You've got the Neoplatonic tradition, which remained very, very much alive. Again, you remember the Cambridge Platonists, who were trying to keep alive the Platonic tradition. You've got Newton, who was, in fact, considered himself more of an alchemist than a physicist. He was much more interested in his alchemical work than in his discovery of gravity and so forth. He saw that simply as an aspect of it, right here in Cambridge, at the same time as the Protestant and the Calvinist traditions were moving along. So you'd got these two quite contrary processes in an uneasy dialogue with each other. But by and large, yes, we're the inheritors of both, of course. But it leaves us with a quite complex relationship with the imaginative world. Perhaps to some extent, a lack of value of it, a lack of sense of its importance and significance. And increasingly, the enthronement of the material world. What you can touch and feel with your physical senses is what is real. Everything else is merely byproduct, merely a side effect, an epiphenomenon. That, I think, is the overall dominating thrust of the culture that we live in today. Even though these other strands are there, and nothing you say about culture ever can be simple, and especially in a culture today that is global, where we're under such varied influences. One of the most important developments in modern history, I think, has been the rise of psychoanalytic schools, and especially of C.G. Jung, because he really began to take seriously the alternative traditions within Western culture and to view them, find a way of looking at them from the perspective of psychology, albeit to some extent from the perspective of psychopathology. He tried to take them seriously. And I think that probably Buddhism would not have been possible in the modern West if it wasn't for the work of C.G. Jung. I tend to think that it wouldn't have been possible without Kant, who really made it possible for us to understand that the external world was not a datum that had to be accepted as completely external to us. And Jung, who pointed out that the imaginative realm is to be taken seriously in its own right, and in some ways more seriously than the realm of conscious identity. So I hope you can sort of understand this sketchy picture that I've drawn in, which at the very least shows the complexity of the situation we're in. In a way, in India, it's simpler. The Buddhist past is long gone. Buddhist images were entirely forgotten and misunderstood. It was not even really recognised amongst modern Indians until the late 19th century that the Buddha had lived and was a real human being, and that that we could find the places where he'd been. So Indians live literally amongst broken images. You go and see the Buddha images, they've got no heads. And they've been brought up with this very, very rich animist universe of also astonishing complexity and depth, which they've had to leave. And because it's so much bound up with a social system and a theory of genetic inheritance, that you are born into a particular caste because of your previous actions. It's all bound up with the whole system. And Dr. Ambedkar pointed out, you can't tinker with it. You can't take this off and select that. It all goes as a whole. So the choice that was made was to dump it. So in a sense, it's simpler, if you see what I mean. There's less ambiguity about it. There's less that it's possible to say, well, we'll take that, but not that. But it leaves them in an even more acutely, imaginatively dry situation. Except that they've got this image of Dr. Ambedkar and the great figures of modern times, great social reformers, who are dealt with in an imaginative way. They're not merely historical figures. There's a great deal of feeling and a great deal of enrichment of the images that go with them. So this is the issue that I'm fascinated by, and increasingly feel urgent about. We need to find a new way of engaging with this, the imagination, bringing it to life for us. We've taken inspiration from the East. Some of us are able to fully put ourselves into that. We can connect fully with the Tibetan pantheon. Some people can do that, and well, that's fine. Those images are images of the collective unconscious, so they are available to all humanity. But my own personal experience and my sense talking to many order members and many others is that this is not widespread. That many of us try dutifully to connect, but it doesn't really quite work or work deeply enough. So it seems to me that we need to tackle in a much more radical way the question of how we connect with imaginatively connect with enlightenment. So these three areas concerned with imagination that I'm going to explore today, which are the ones that I explored with Bhante in my recent conversations. I'm in the middle of writing all this, so my thoughts are not entirely clear. They're not clear at all. But since we're dealing with imagination, that's entirely appropriate. That's my excuse. But I'm going to try to work things out by communicating them to you and hearing what responses you've got. What I want to try to do is explore, first of all, the area of, animism, the animated world. Bhante says in Living with Awareness that a universe that is not considered alive is not a universe within which enlightenment can take place. He doesn't justify it, he simply asserts it. That, it were, to put it less negatively, unless you can see the world as alive, animated, really enlightenment has no place. So we'll look more deeply at that, what that means, and how we might explore that, how we are exploring that. The second area that we explored, which again is one I feel is of key importance to the development of Buddhism in the modern world, is the world of aesthetic experience and of art. I put aesthetic experience because that's broader, it includes the experience of nature, and well, I like to place the notion of art quite high, if you like. And not all that is an aesthetic experience is necessarily art, if you see what I mean. But so art aesthetic experience includes art, but not all that's art is aesthetic. All that's art is aesthetic experience, but not all that's aesthetic experience is art. It's a long time since I did logic, but I think that's right. So that whole area of our response to the aesthetic, put it rather old-fashionedly, to the beautiful. Our natural responses to it. How do they work themselves out? How are they to be worked into the context of our practice of the Dhamma? Then the third area is our response to the Buddha and the way in which the Buddha lives in our imaginations, both visionary imaginations and our figured imaginations, imaginations as embodied in images around us. How is that to be taken forward? How are we to be able to successfully engage with that? And part of the reason why I'm so interested in this is that I've developed in my own experience and in my looking at other people or hearing other people a strong sense that our imaginative connection with the Buddha is real, but not necessarily connected with sadhana, if you see what I mean. So there's an odd sort of mismatch that we have, many of us, a very strong connection with the Buddha, but it doesn't go into the forms that we've got. Again, please, if it works for you, I'm not criticising you or saying that you've got to stop it. Yeah. It could include, yes, it can. I deliberately this morning tried to say enlightenment. So, yes, although we'll come on to why I'm saying the Buddha, but yes, when I say the Buddha, I do not mean, Shakyamuni, Gautama Shakyamuni, who sat underneath the Bodhi tree. I mean a broader category which includes him, although we know that category through him. So he has a vital place in it. So, yes. Thank you. When I say the Buddha, or what I really should be saying is Bodhi. I'll try to say that from now on. It's a connection with Bodhi that I think we have through Tara for some of us, through Shakyamuni for others. For others, a much more shadowy, inchoate, not even necessarily envisioned experience. I think that in the end is what it is for me. I know that the Buddha is a very strong, and I mean the Buddha, is a very strong presence in my life. But I couldn't tell you what he looked like. But he's there. We'll talk more about all this. But yes, these three are the areas that I want to talk about, and hopefully if I can stop talking myself, get some of you to talk too. I'm an inveterate talker. So yes, these three areas are the ones that I talked about with Bhante, and I include them all under the heading of imagination. Bhante has talked here and there quite a bit about imagination, more in conversation. I remember it particularly in the two Tuscanies that I went on, the Il Convento ordination retreats I went on in 81 and 82, or 80 and 81, where Rudra Ketu was ordained. And there was a lot of discussion of that, do you remember? And very, very inspiring. But not much of that has expressed itself in written work. There's the Journey to Il Convento and St. Jerome Revisited, which both are the nearest Bhante comes to a theory of imagination. Of course, there's the Religion of Art, which touches on those sort of themes. And a few things he's written about art touch on these themes. But he's never really brought it all together, and never really fully expressed what he means by imagination. But to me it seemed that these three areas of discussion that I've outlined come under that heading. The animation of the world, the response to the aesthetic, and our response to enlightenment, to Bodhi. Our imaginative response to Bodhi. How Bodhi expresses itself for us, because our words can't get it. So something in us does get it. What is it? How does it work? How do we strengthen it? That's what sadhana is supposed to be about. So how do we rediscover sadhana so that it does, if we haven't already, and I think probably many people have for themselves. How do we do it so that it's much, much more effective? These are the three things I want to talk about. And I wanted to start by trying to collect my thoughts on the theme of imagination. But before I do that, just so that I don't talk, let's have some questions, or statements, or contentions. Yeah.
And then you just said imagination, so
you're confused.
Sorry.
You're what, sorry?
I thought sorry, I was looking forward to the answer.
You'll get there. Why I want to talk about imagination first is because I see the ability to pick up on the animated universe as a function of imagination. So sort of for my way of thinking, it's sort of, I want to talk about the faculty so that I can better talk about the way it functions. Yeah? So I hope that you can contain your sadness. But thanks, I gave a confusing message. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you talk about the problem the Indian Buddhists have, not being, they've had to cut themselves off from the Hindu pantheon. They left it just... poor imitation of rationalism. I wonder to what extent this problem is an artificial problem, because the Buddhism and the Buddha is an Indian figure, and it's very much there in the Indian history. If you look, the places of pilgrimages are there. You get a very strong sense of the Buddha.
Yeah.
So it's very much there for those who want to, those who can discover.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah.
But I think. Isn't it more the problem of an emphasis that Dr. Ambedkar's figure has been emphasized a lot more than the figure of the historical Buddha?
Well, I think that's a natural consequence of the social and political circumstances. But it is a real problem, if you see what I mean. I can't see it as an artificial one. It's been created by conditions. But there's a lot of work to be done to animate the figure of the Buddha. So it's in that sense that I'm talking of it as a problem. But it's a little bit more than that. You may not know, actually, Sujiva, but many ex-Catholics have a great deal of difficulty with a puja, because they feel the holy water descending on their heads or whatever, or they feel the shadow of the confessional. So it's a similar sort of association. The whole imaginative world is connected with Hinduism. Do you see what I mean? Yes, the way out is in a sense simple, as it is for us in the West. It's simple, go for refuge to the Buddha. But the problem is that the understanding of imagination itself is caught up with the rejection of an oppressive social system. Do you see what I mean? So that if your experience in Christianity has been one of irrational guilt, you don't want to go back there. You don't want to go there. Even though many people with a Catholic background have actually got quite a strong sense of a higher reality. And often have a terrible ambiguity in yourself. You don't want to go to the irrational guilt, but you don't want to lose the strong sense of a higher reality. So I think that you can see by analogy how it works for people from especially from a Dalit background, and I think it will affect people from an upper caste background too. You associate the imaginative realm, as particularly the imaginative realm in depth, with a system that is corrupt. With superstition. Yeah, I mean, there's so much superstition in Hinduism. And it's corrupt. I think there's, by and large. It sort of works. India does work. But with terrible suffering. So I think I'm not just talking about a factual cultural problem. I'm talking about a deep psychic kink, if you see what I mean. A knot that gets tied in the psyche. My attempt at a history of the imagination in the West was to try to sort of at least indicate some of the complexity of these knots that, you know, your poor Western brothers and sisters are tied in. You innocent Indian. You've probably got a much cleaner relationship with that world in a certain sense.
Connecting with the historical Buddha is a way forward.
Yes, for both, I think it's for both, it's a way forward. But there needs to be some exploration of the kinks, of the knots, if you see what I mean. There needs to be some recognition of them. But this is what I'm arguing anyway. I'm trying to put that on the table and sort of say, we've got a strange situation, both East and West. And we need to face that strange situation and discover our way forward afresh. Not imposing on ourselves forms that come successfully that come from successful cultures that are different from our own, that do not have the same history and the same imaginative forms. So do you see what I mean? I agree with you. But I think that there's a dimension to what the problem that you're not touching. I think
imagination and everything you've said about it so far, with that, you've mainly used the visual metaphor.
Yes.
But my experience has got it to be almost entirely kinesthetic.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm realising why formless meditation has been so important.
Yeah.
Because that has been my worst sadhana.
Yeah.
I just want to flag that up.
Yeah. No, I was going to say that when we use the word imagination, we must use it with awareness of its etymological meaning. If you see what I mean, it's not to do with visual image; it's to do with any object of the senses, including the senses that is harder to express, the kinesthetic sense, the sense of spatial location. A telepathic sense of a presence and so forth. So yes, when I use imagination, I mean it in that broader sense. Very important. That's why deliberately this morning I did not put. I tried to avoid putting any images in. Visual content to it. I probably others would be better at doing this than me, but I'm trying to find a way of talking that speaks or doesn't cut off any real imaginative contact through any particular avenue. Pamajata, you were. Dharmashala, yeah.
Bandhi's experience with him that he took to the forms of Tibetan Buddhism, but perhaps later on
Yeah. Well, Bhante, as always, is a rather unusual man, and he seems never to have taken the Mr. Petten forms. he told me that he was never really attracted to Tibetan Buddhism, which is strange because that's I think I put in my article that probably some people looking at the FWBO TBMSG, what are we? Tree Ratna, would think of us as a deviant Tibetan sect. But he said that he'd never particularly attracted to that. It happens that most of his teachers are Tibetans, but he was attracted to them as human beings, not as Tibetan Buddhists. And although, you know, he appreciated much in Tibetan Buddhism, there was much he really did not like and felt was counterproductive and degenerative. When he started, though, that visualization practice, it seems as if the figures completely lived for him. He felt the connection. And you remember what he says about seeing the image of Padmasambhava in that monastery in Darjeeling, that he felt it was a presence that he'd always known. So he seems to have been able to connect with those images beyond their particular formal expressions. But it's fairly clear that for him it took on a life of its own, and the images began to live independent of any sort of stimulus they were given. And again, a thing about Bhante is that he's a strange mixture of extraordinarily faithful and even traditional, and the most radical and individual. So that it seems as if, you know, he had no difficulty about having the tankas there and the images and so forth, but they never restricted him. And he never felt culturally bound by them. And to some extent, I think this is because he had such a rich imaginative life, in the fuller sense that I've been outlining already, that for him the world was animated, and that for him aesthetic experience was constant. Remember, he described to me his very first conscious aesthetic experience. It was when he was, he thinks, 3 or 4, walking into a garden where, I can't remember what the flowers were, but which was full of a particular sort of flower with a very strong sense. And he said it almost knocked him out. A very strong response to the sense experience, the beauty of the sense experience. So he seems to have had a very, very strong imagination, not to have been sort of subject to the sort of kind of complexities that I've outlined. I don't know why. One can speculate, but that's pretty useless. So for him, it doesn't seem to have been an issue. And as with so many of these things, I mean, many of the things that we might regret he'd done, I think come about because he's just so different. His own experience seems to be so naturally unfolding for him. He can't understand that others aren't doing the same. Hmm.
So Viti, I've been talking a bit about the work you've done in the past to explore the differences of individual personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just a sense in what you're talking about, there can be a feeling that you're talking about something that some of us may not understand.
Hmm.
Whereas actually I think you may be saying that each of us has a job to do to find out what we are individually. You know, we have different imagination, you know, we're built differently, each of us individually are built differently.
Sure.
Hmm. And so the task is an individual one to take that on.
Yes.
And find out how it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
And particularly how the imagination works.
Yeah. Yeah, very nicely put.
And bearing in mind all the cultural conditioning you were talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted to add a point. I do a lot of interfaith work these days, and particularly circulate with Muslims.
Mm.
And I've been really struck by how differently they seem to be built as
indeed.
Human beings.
Indeed, yeah.
Because their conditioning is so fundamental, particularly with the imagination.
Yeah.
They almost don't seem to have one.
Yeah, and then you must differentiate between the Sunni and the Shiites, because
yes,
the Shiites have a much richer imaginative
right.
life. Yeah, yeah.
But the more conventional Muslims have this very abstract imagination.
Yeah, But what you fundamentally said is very true, and it's exactly what I want to do, is just to try to emphasise that in a way we've each of us got to find our way forward. We each actually are finding our way forward, and we must, I think, feel a greater confidence in that process, because it's from us doing it, and doing it together, that Buddhism will grow in the West.
Yes, you spoke just now about the superstitious attitude of Indian Hinduism. But do you not think...
Sorry, the superficial attitude of
Hinduism.
Superstitious, yeah.
Hinduism in India.
Yeah.
And differentiating the Indian situation from over here.
Mm-hmm.
But do you not think that we still have quite a problem with superstition over here, particularly in the form of revitalised fundamentalist Christianity?
Oh,
You know, you look at people the way that people look at horoscopes, for example.
Sure.
And they will say things like, I'll just do it for a bit of fun. You say, well, what are you looking at there? You
know? Yeah, yeah.
The secret is a part
sure.
of which is it was true.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
There's quite a lot of it that's still over here. And how do you differentiate a kind of engagement with the imagination, which doesn't swallow off into that superstition?
Indeed,
realm?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I still think it's a real problem.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good question. Yeah. Well, I think that this is partly why I wanted to start with an exploration of imagination, because I think one of the things one has to deal with is the ontology of imagination. Yes, so I'll try to deal with it under that heading if I can be clever enough by the time it comes up. Yes, I think there's a job to be done of differentiating. This is one of the things I have to do in India, is to try to, with people who are relatively uneducated, which doesn't mean stupid by any means, but to try to show a difference between what I call a poetic imagination and a superstition. So I think that that's part of the job I will try to do.
Is Bhante happy about this thing we are discussing here, imagination, because Bhante taught sadhanas to people. You're bringing this issue. And is Bhante happy about it when we are discussing?
Oh yes, I'm really expressing his ideas. As usual, most of what I say is Bhante, and just my attempt to understand it expressed for others. So yes, we taught, he and I, a couple of months ago about the field of imagination, and he said that he would like us to differentiate ourselves much more fully and completely from Tibetan Buddhism, which does not mean that we should discard it or discount it or discredit it, but that we should not identify ourselves with it. We can draw from it, we can draw inspiration from it, and he would like us to more radically try to discover the Buddha. So what I will be expressing are at least my understanding of Bhante's ideas. Of course, it's all a bit tentative, and what it exactly means we're going to have to work out amongst us through discussion and dialogue. But yes, I wouldn't go trashing anything without knowing that Bhante wouldn't tell me off later. I've covered my back.
I suppose I'm slightly surprised to hear you talking about this problem of leaving behind an imagination as a new problem, because actually it's been the problem for Buddhists since the Buddha. And I'm one of my areas of interest in studying Pali texts is precisely the place of Vedic gods in the imagination of early Buddhism.
Mm.
So, you know, Indra makes very regular appearances representing the old Vedic gods, Brahma as the new Vedic gods.
Mm.
plus all of the yakshas and nagas and all of those more...
etc, etc,
the village deities, you know, they're all there and people are actually dealing with that problem. But it actually goes on through the Mahayana Sutra to the Tantras as well. And it seems like there's a well-worked-out methodology there that Buddhists have employed that would work both for new Buddhists in India and for
Well, I think I disagree there. I think that the methodology runs out because of the complexity of the history, both East and West, if you see what I mean. But I think that the Buddha and his successors worked within a natural assumption of living imagination. I don't think we exist within that world anymore. And in India, as I say, people have had to, in a certain sense, cut themselves from it. So I think part of the problem we face is that the continuity in that respect has to be reworked.
I'm not sure that you understand the point I'm making.
Well, it may be that you're not understanding mine, but...
What I'm saying is that the sense that we don't have to abandon what we already have. I mean, what the Buddhists seem to have done down through the ages is incorporate all of their cultural baggage in a way that subsumes it.
I did understand what you said, and I still disagree. We'll go into it a bit later. Unfortunately, in a way, bits of issues coming up, which I'm going to deal with as I go along. And I invited questions, so it's fair enough. But I can't really, do you know what I mean, without taking on a topic that I'd need to have some background to give some background to, I can't really take on what you're talking about. But it seems to me that there is a radical difference about the situation that we're in, that we cannot simply bring, you know, like Lama Yeshe tried to create a Christ visualization. It just doesn't cut the ice. There's a more radical a break that's taken place because of the complexity of Western civilization. The only time Buddhism has really encountered a developed higher civilization before is China. But it was still a traditional society. It was still a pre-modern society with an animated world. The radical difference for us is the Enlightenment. The European Enlightenment, I mean. But I'll hold your question and come back later. Shall we plunge into the imagination?
Yes.
Try and give you, at least, if I can pull... I'm sort of aware that I'm just dealing with such huge issues and everybody's thought about these things and it's quite difficult to pick up threads that people dangle before me. So I'm just going to try to remind myself of what I've said. Yes, what's... obvious reading into what Bhante's got to say about imagination is that he's drawn very strongly on the tradition of imagination, which particularly gets expressed by the Romantics. And I think probably you could say that Coleridge is a bigger influence on the movement than many other figures, ironically. And the conception of imagination that Bhante starts with seems to come from Coleridge in Biographia Literaria. And he conceives of imagination as a... let me just remind myself, I've written it all up. Yes. Well, first of all, as a power or capacity or faculty that everybody has. It's, again, without defining what it does, it's something that we all have. The capacity to respond to images in the broadest sense. So that the issue is not of creating an imagination, the issue is of activating imagination. We all do respond in various ways. We respond to the world as alive. We respond to aesthetic experience. We respond to images that express some sort of higher reality. But It's undeveloped, and because it's not even recognised in general discourse, we don't even know we've got it. So it's a capacity that we've got, latent, to some extent active, but largely unrecognised. And the issue that we face is of bringing it into play, bringing it more and more into play. Bante says that it's not really that we've got an imagination, that we are one thing, an imagination is something else. He says that in the end, we are imagination. Imagination is the human mind. It is the human being, integrated, functioning at a more subtle and responsive level. It's us as not separate, us as connected, us as interacting. So that, in a way, what we have to do is discover that we've got that as a capacity, and then discover that that capacity is us. That's what Bante seems to be arguing, that it's this faculty that is the vehicle of spiritual life, and in a sense the object of spiritual life. That spiritual life is concerned with discovering and activating that faculty, but also, in a sense, becoming that faculty. So, there you are. Hold that as a definition. It's worth saying a little bit more about it, because, of course, the idea of imagination implies a means of knowing. Imagination knows its objects. And one of the features of imagination as a faculty is that it knows its objects directly. It's not like the intellect, which knows only through conceptualization. It's more like seeing. And that's why the metaphor of imagination is derived from the senses. So it's a faculty that has direct access to its objects. Secondly, imagination, yes, we have imagination, we are imagination, but imagination is, in a sense, more than us. Imagination has in it, when you experience it functioning, something that is bigger than you. The sense is of something, as it were, I was going to say taking you over, but that perhaps is too strong a metaphor, but something intervening into your own experience. The most characteristic mode of that is in artistic creation. My limited experience on solitary retreat, I was washing my hands one day and a line of a poem came into my mind. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And another line came. And then another line. I never decided to have a poem. It just wrote itself, and it wasn't a bad one. But the definite experience was that it was not mine. I did not create it. It created itself. And I think that's a characteristic of all imaginative experience, that there's something more than you, something beyond you that's involved in it. You may experience it as even the famous muse or a god or whatever. You may experience it as something definitely exterior to you, even personified, embodied. But whether you do that or not, you will definitely have some sense that something is entering in that's more than you. That's the character of imagination. And this leads to a very important consideration in dealing with imagination. We've seen that if we consider imagination as a faculty that we've got but that we need to mature, it means we need to identify it, to recognise it, and to encourage it, to feed it. If we consider imagination as something that's more than individual, it implies something about the attitude with which we develop it. And again, I find the neatest expression of what that is in another romantic poet, Keats, who famously wrote to his brother that you need for imagination negative capability. That is a suspension of the irritable questing after resolution. The ability to rest with mysteries, uncertainties and doubts. Happily to remain in the midst of these uncertainties. So that you are recognizing there's something bigger than you that is not under your control, and that your understanding, your conceptual understanding, cannot get hold of necessarily. You may be able to rationalize it, but you won't be able to grasp it, if you see what I mean. You may be able to put it into words, as I'm trying to do now, but you won't be able to fix it. So that there's this capacity to stay with not knowing. Interesting enough, I think this might be a very interesting way of teaching just sitting, negative capability. Just sitting is the capacity to remain with uncertainties, mysteries and doubts without an irritable questing after resolution. You're just able to sit there not knowing, not really clear, not really certain, but still there, still present. And Keats later, rather delightfully, started to talk about this as indolence. There's that not very successful poem, Ode to Indolence. But I rather like this idea that indolence is a spiritual practice. I've been trying to do it. It's very difficult, actually. Some people I know are very good at it. But by indolence, he means this sort of letting go of egoistic purpose, letting go of conscious aims and objectives, letting go of really getting a grip on what's going on, understanding it. Very difficult for somebody of my temperament. Staying just open to what happens. And it's in that, Keats said, that poetic inspiration arises. And Shelley has a lot to say very similar to this, and Coleridge very wordily has even more to say about it. That quotation from Keats to his brother, it rather delightfully then goes on to say that you need to have negative capability, not like Coleridge, who spent, what was it, several hundred pages discussing how we all like beauty. That's the way he appeared to his compares. Anyway, imagination has this something more than the individual. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, has two dimensions to it. In traditional terms, we talk about inspiration arising within the dhyanas. You know, Bhante talks about the second dhyana, as a stage of inspiration, that there's a subterranean spring arising in which something is coming into your experience that's from beyond your experience. This is within the samsaric world, it's within the karmic world, not necessarily the kamic world. So under the influence of karma, because you've recreated your mind in a more subtle and open way, experiences begin to arise within your mind that come from beyond your conscious identity. You begin to sense inspirations, intuitions, images that come from beyond you. They're not necessarily anything to do with the Dhamma, if you see what I mean. They're from deeper or higher levels of the ordinary mind. But the ordinary mind, in a sense that we very seldom experience it. And no doubt this is what many artists and mystics and so forth experience. It's inspiration of this kind, coming from some much vaster dimension of consciousness that, from the point of view of the ordinary mind, is experienced as other. It's very interesting, isn't it, that in the Brahmajala Sutta, the Buddha explains the majority at least, of the wrong views that people gain as arising from a misinterpretation of genuine experience. So people have a real experience, which is the raw experience is a genuine one, but it's then doctrinalized. And this is why Bhante said that we should be careful to, first of all, accept and describe raw experience. If you have an experience in meditation, don't hasten to fit it into a doctrinal category. It's this, it's that, it's third dhyana, it's second dhyana, it's Tathagata Garbha or whatever. Just accept the raw experience and try to describe the details of it. But we have this restless, irritable desire for certainty and fixity. And in doing so, we miss the splendour and the depth of the experience itself. So it may be that the experience is very likely that experiences of imagination have this character of coming from beyond our conscious identity as arising from our karmic development. But it may be also that, yeah.
I don't know, going ahead, but do you think the arising of insight is at all possible without the imagination?
Without?
The imagination.
No. But I'll come to that. In a way, I'm imagination is the faculty also that experiences insight, according to Bhante. So, I've talked about the karmic kind of experience of imagination, but there's a dharmic kind of experience of imagination. Once karmic development has reached a certain pitch and one has decisively held back that irritable questing for certainty in the form of I, if you see what I mean. That's what I is. It's a grasping onto something as a source of security. So once you're able to let go of that, once you have the negative capability of an Atman, then new processes arise, new experiences arise within the imagination or as imaginative experiences, of all kinds, whether of a visual kind or a kinesthetic kind or located within your body, which belong to the realm of insight, belong to the realm of the Dharma. So imagination has within it something that's more than your conscious self-identity, which may be beyond you in the karmic sense, it may be beyond you in the dharmic sense. Yes, and for Bhante, the imagination becomes the vehicle of the entire spiritual life. That as we progress in the spiritual life, this faculty of responsiveness gains greater and greater subtlety and fineness, so it's able to take in the ultimate nature of things. Without it, our insight is only an intellectual understanding. So the imagination for Bhante is the whole mind uplifted, inspired, free from restricting constraints from the graspings that hold it back, the irritable holding on to fixities. The next characteristic of imagination, a little bit harder to get into. I hope I can manage this. But imagination transforms the objects of experience. Our ordinary senses take in the world organized primarily for our survival. So we take in the world around us in terms of its usefulness to us as animals, you could say, as intelligent animals. So that we see the objects around us for their utility to us, for their enhancement of our own immediate pleasure and their ability to help us avoid pain. But imagination invests the objects of our experience with deeper and deeper sensory meaning. So that the kind of epitome of this would be poetic experience, where you see a classic object. Because we're in Holland at the moment. My favourite example in this respect is Van Gogh's boots. You know the famous painting of the pair of boots, which they're extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary, because they live as I don't know, I can even talk about it. They live as objects quite independent of their literal meaning, as things that keep your feet dry and so forth. They become poignant, poetic, beautiful, fascinating, and even a bit wry. Something ironic about them. Something completely beyond what their meaning is for whoever's boots they were. So imagination invests the ordinary objects of experience with a meaning that strikes far beyond their ordinary significance. So that as imagination comes into play more and more vigorously, more and more constantly, the world becomes full of meaning. It becomes an enriched world, a world of meaning, in which every object is a symbol. That's the function of imagination. It transforms ordinary sensuous experience into symbolic experience. And symbolic experience is, of course, not signifying. It doesn't simply tell you a meaning, as it were. What it does is open up gateways of experience, and they're multivalent. Those boots probably mean as many things as there are people who look at them. The experience of imagination is not one that closes objects off, but opens up, uncovers their deep potential meaning, ultimately uncovers their significance as dharmic. I sometimes think that this is the significance of Vairochana's Dhammadhatu jnana, that he sees the entire world as the sphere of the Dharma. So everything that he looks at is a gateway to the Dharma. Everything he looks at is a gateway to truth. Whatever he sees is transformed into meaning. It doesn't mean that he doesn't see the boots, as it were. But he sees those boots as expressive of the ultimate nature of things. So imagination takes the ordinary objects of experience and goes beyond them. Transforms those objects in the sense of investing them with significance. Ultimately, imagination invests the whole of reality, the whole universe, with significance, with meaning.
And then philosophically, with what you're just saying, because you can also see it in the way that the person who sees the object sees reality.
I'm sorry, you can't?
I said, you cannot see also in the way that the person...
You can't see, I'm a bit deaf, so you need to speak very clearly.
I said, the person who looks at the object, what he sees can also be explained, I think, in terms of what he sees is reality. So I have a little bit of problem with the transforming sometimes.
Right,
Because I think it's not always, I don't experience that so active. It's something that's also, it is the first
thing. Yeah. It's a little bit difficult to carry out the discussion. I'm realising I've done something rather stupid by venturing upon this in a public context. In a way, what you need to do is enter into the universe of discourse that I'm using and evaluate it later, if you see what I mean. You will find conflicts with your own ways of thinking and talking. I'm trying to introduce you to an alternative way of looking at things that takes off once we've got right view straight. Last night I talked about the importance of, first of all, getting right view straight, being clear about eternalism and nihilism. Then we need a language to talk about the process that we engage in to come to see things as they really are. And Bante's suggested to us this language of imagination. It's fraught with philosophical problems because it's an imaginative language. It's a metaphorical language. So you need to empathise for a while with the metaphor that I'm going to be using and recognise that it will insult your own understandings at certain points. So if you could exercise a little negative capability in respect of the way I'm talking, unless I've misunderstood you.
I think I wasn't very clear. What I meant is my own experience, which is not that I actually feel I'm transforming something, is something I'm opening up to something bigger that impinges itself on me.
Ah, okay. Well, I don't think that's incompatible with what I said, if you see what I mean. It's a different way of expressing the same thing. Yeah. But in a way, what, of course, the starting point for the discussion of imagination is the world of aesthetic creation, artistic creation. So that, it's a point that Coleridge made, that the artist transforms the object. And the perfect example is the one that I've just given of Van Gogh's boots. That he, in his own way of seeing those boots, and then his aesthetic creation, transforms the object, which is the starting point, into something that is of far greater significance. So I'm talking from that point of view, if you see what I mean, which I think meets your point of view. Okay, good. I thought we were in. I'm terrified that I'm skating over huge philosophical problems and theoretical problems that people will be arrested by. I'm aware that I've taken on a topic that's far too big for me. Actually, it's too big for all of us. But I'm just trying to sort of flesh out an approach that I hope will give us the basis for further inquiry. Yeah?
Is it okay to ask a question?
Sure.
Time,
yeah. Gee. Yeah. Bolier.
Yeah. You said imagination is more than us. Yeah.
Is
more than us.
Yeah.
And what is the difference between imagination and psychic thing?
Huh. And the psychic phenomenon. Yeah. In the sense of telepathy or something of that kind. Well, I would say those are examples of imagination at work. Imagination is not merely something made up, if you see what I mean. Imagination is a real connection with things. And that may take the form of a psychic connection, if you see what I mean. So that would be one manifestation of it. But I'll talk more about it. But it's not its primary manifestation. Yeah? I think the problem may be that imagination in ordinary usage, and certainly in Indian English usage, would be simply something made up. You're imagining things. But in Western culture, imagination takes on a much larger meaning. It's something that is not merely imaginary. It's something that is really effective.
So, Peter, surely that actually touches on the point that we were talking about earlier, that when you're talking about imagination as something just made up, then that is exactly where the point of superstition starts coming in, where you're just fictitiously making things up and by imbuing them with a meaning they don't actually have.
Well, what I would say is you're literalising your experience.
Right.
You're reading your experience in that is on one level in literal terms on another level.
Quite a few people I know have been looking at a book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
All right, yeah.
Which I think might explain some of this, that the left side of the brain is very much, it's articulate, it's controlling, trying to understand things. And I've been doing some drawing groups where we try and sort of distract the left side. So the right side, which is imaginative, creative, and childlike, just has free rein, and it's. I think a lot of this can be explained by that. The fact that if we can distract that left side, then we've got access to all this creativity and imagination. I'm confused now whether, sorry, just the discussion's taking me off track. Are you saying that with the faculty of imagination we transform what we see, or the other way around, it transforms us?
It's the both. It's both. It just depends which way you start. If you start from the point of view of the creator, as it were, in the sense of aesthetic creation, well, clearly it you can see that there's a transformation of the object. But equally, you could talk about it the other way around, because the one of the things about imagination is it begins to break down the clear distinction between image and imaginer. Yes, well, it is the intersubjective realm, intermediate between our ordinary conscious identity and the a transcendental identity, to use that term. So, Bante, in the Religion of Art, no, in St. Jerome Revisited, or one of those, says something like, in the end, what is happening is image is perceiving image. So that, yes, you're in a realm where inevitably if you start discussing it in one way, somebody will need to point out you could talk about it another way. But because what's happening is that you're crossing the boundaries. They're still there, but the boundaries are much more fluid, much more interactive. So yes, you are transforming the object by reading into it. You're transforming it in the sense that you're perceiving within the object far greater meaning. But your experience will be that far greater meaning is revealing itself to you. You won't think, ah, I think I'll make that much more significant. You'll discover significance in it. Coleridge, a very, very interesting thinker, he distinguishes between imagination and fancy. I think it's a very, very useful distinction. And I realised it's the background to Bante's distinction between mind reactive and creative. Coleridge and then reading Mind Creative and Reactive, I realise, as with so often with Bante, he's sort of his influences are showing, and what Coleridge discusses fancy as the sort of poetry which of course he was not very keen on, in which images are put together in a quite artificial way. The other day I had the misfortune to hear a Bach cantata, a wonderful cantata, beautifully sung, but with a running translation of the German on the screen. And it was one of those cantatas from the Day of Atonement. So it's all about what a miserable, terrible sinner I am. But anyway, it's German pietism, which was seeking to make Christian experience much more real and personal, sort of beginning of romanticization, if you like. So in this hymn, the words of this cantata, absolutely ravishing cantata, the words are, let me bathe myself in your blood, let me rest myself in your wounds as on a rock. Off turned. I couldn't listen. It's just a horrible image, and a completely artificially created image. Somebody has tried to create an image that expresses Orthodox Christian, and particularly Lutheran pietist dogma, for a particular day of service. So the image is an absolutely classic production of fancy. It's an image because you've got to have an image. And don't we all do it? You know, you're giving a talk, and you know that when you give a talk, you must give an image. So you then say, that reminds me of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, etc. So it's an unfelt, unrealized image, which is mechanically produced. Somebody was pointing out to me that a lot of computer games are to do with simply recombining images in different forms and playing them out in different ways. But there's a sort of appearance of creativity because you're putting something together in a new way. But nothing new in a deeper creative sense has come into being. So I found a very interesting article by the one of the chief devisers of virtual reality, who was bemoaning the lack of creativity to which it was being put. It was very interesting. I would have thought he should have guessed that beforehand, but that's another matter. So fancy is the artificial assemblage of things without any reaching at deeper meaning. Imagination, Coleridge says, unifies images in a natural way, so that they have a unity in a deeper meaning. Of course, I can't immediately think of anything, but so the image comes together in a way that's satisfying to the creator, and that imparts, communicates to the hearer or the perceiver a sense of deeper meaning. Whereas fancy insults you, and you feel turned off unless you bought into a sort of cultural set of kind of conventional responses. You see what I mean? So that if you're a pietist, when you hear the image of bathing in blood and resting on in a wound as on a rock, you'll presumably sort of think of yourself as having certain responses. Tends to sentimentality, Coleridge said. So imagination discovers a deeper meaning within the objects of experience and reveals them in aesthetic experience, or in meditative experience, dwells upon them.